It's so important to try to connect HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah and His HaKadosh Baruch Hu's infinite will to events that unfold in our world. Obviously, the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is timeless and immortal and beyond. And when we study Gemara, we don't just study it for current events or for revelatory, sociological, anthropological truths, but it's still important not to cordon off Torah because, number one, for some, that just frames Torah as something yellow and outdated and irrelevant. And obviously, the people who are insiders to Torah understand that relevance doesn't have to come from correspondence or correlation to political events or headlines. But I think for some people, it's important to maintain that tethering. And of course, Torah is both. It's both grounded just as it's timeless and it's soaring. And more importantly, because Torah teaches us how to navigate and how to proceed. And it's true about moral questions. It's true about the medical crisis. And I know so many people, I'd like to think myself included, has tried very hard to uncover ideas, values, guidelines within Torah, within the Parsha, within Yom Tovim for how to process and how to experience the corona crisis. And it's true about historical events. And certainly events in Israel are historical in ways that events outside of Israel oftentimes they're not, because every major event in Israel has historical resonance and historical impact. So it's important to use Tanakh and to use the Torah and to use Nevi'im as a code for trying to process end of history events. It's also important not to be too brash and too confident, too specific. This relates to this. This foretells this. This is prescient about that, because that's a violation of the awe and the humility that a person addresses HaKadosh Baruch Hu with in general, and certainly when it comes to these areas of Achris HaYamim, the famous story of Yaakov, who wanted to relay the details of Achris HaYamim to his children, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu prevented him. And again, the prevention is not just logistical, because he may get it wrong. The prevention is, as Chazal feel, is because this is the world of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and peering too, gawking too confidently into that world is disrespectful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. All that being said, as a nice introduction, nice framing, an event happened today which feels literally ripped from the pages of Re'eh, ripped from Parshas Re'eh, ripped from a Rashi in Re'eh, and ripped from a parallel Rashi in Parshas V'zoseh Bracha that I'd like to connect. Today, the State of Israel announced, along with two other countries, the resumption or the normalization of diplomatic relations between the United Arab Emirates, UAE, and the State of Israel. Now, this represents a long process of trying to create formalized peace, cold peace, but nonetheless peace, lack of aggression. This peace, because we don't really share a border with them, unlike the Egyptian and the Jordanian peace, promises, or at least indicates, possibly a warmer peace, more of a collaboration and not just a cold peace, more of a union of interest or an overlapping of interests. And of course, the price paid for that was the withdrawal of the plans of returning sovereignty to lands that were once part of the Israeli homeland, and one day when Mashiach arrives, will ultimately be part of the Israeli homeland. And I'm sure that this raises a lot of thoughts within people's hearts. What to make of it? Is this favorable? Is this horrific? Is this tragic? Is this... And I'm not here to offer political guidance. A lot of people have political questions, how this will land, but rather historical and prophetic perspective on the fact that Jewish history is cyclical, the fact that what happens in 2020 happened 2,000 years ago and 3,000 years ago, and these are templates that repeat themselves and they express themselves differently. The names are different, the players are different, but the models of history are the same. And just to provide that historical background can frame the experience. So it all washes to a Rashi in the middle of Re'eh and Devarim Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Yud Zayin, of all things. The Torah is discussing the fact that we should transfer our Maaser Sheni, the part of the Maaser, the battery of Maaseros of tithes that we deliver to the Kohen, to the Levi. Maaser Sheni, you take the food and you eat it in Yerushalayim. If the food is too heavy to carry, then you redeem it for money, and you take the money and purchase food in Yerushalayim. Take some Bitcoin to Yerushalayim. Torah says, Lo tuchal lechol bisherecha. You cannot eat the Maaser Sheni at home, but rather travel to Yerushalayim. Now, of course, you can. No one's stopping you. Lotuchal doesn't mean lotuchal, that you can't, that you won't be able to. It just means that it's us, or you should travel to Yerushalayim. And for some reason, the Torah writes lotuchal lechol, you can't eat, rather than lotochal, which is the more classic articulation. Of course, Rashi senses this and cites the Medrash. The Medrash says, well, there's one other place in Tanakh where physically, logistically, people had the opportunity to, but they were barred or they were withheld for either halachic reasons or moral reasons. In Yehoshua Perek Tesvav, it describes the Yavusi, who were residents of Yerushalayim, whom the tribe of Yehuda, who were tasked with conquering the environs of Yerushalayim, they couldn't conquer. V'shayavusi yoshevei Yerushalayim lo yachlu b'nei Yehuda l'arisham. Now that's odd. The Yavusi weren't known as such great warriors. They had fortresses. Of course, the name Tzion relates to the fortress of Tzion that existed near the Har Habayis of today. But it seems as if Rabbi Shor ben Karcha says, not that they couldn't militarily overcome the Yavusi, but they were barred. So just like they were barred from entering Yerushalayim, so too you are barred from staying at home. You must travel to Yerushalayim with your Maaser Sheni. That's the context within which Rashi describes. Now, what's interesting for us is, why were the Jewish people or the tribe of Yehuda barred or banned from Yerushalayim, even though the Tanakh says they couldn't? It really means they weren't allowed to, not that they couldn't militarily. So this is where it gets interesting. Medrash says, it appears in several Midrashim, that Avraham formed an alliance with one of two parties. It's not clear. There are different versions of the Medrash. I'll cite the most popular version of the Medrash with his good friend Avimelech. His good friend Avimelech, in Parshas Vayera, and we'll talk about the setting of the Parsha. So Avimelech plays the moral card. He says, I've been so kind to you. I've let you live with us. I've defended you. I've befriended you in Tishkor Li, Ulini, Ulinechti. And he makes him take an oath that there shouldn't be hostilities. That's the simple reading of Parshas Vayera. Chazal say the oath wasn't just about detente, or peace and reconciliation between Avimelech and Avraham Avinu, but that Avraham's descendants could not enter Yerushalayim, where the Yevusim, descendants of Avimelech, would ultimately live. Now, tracing the Yevusim, who ultimately lived in Yerushalayim, back to the Plishtim of Avimelech is no easy task, but Chazal assume that there's some connection between the Yavusim who inhabit Yerushalayim when the Jews enter Eretz Yisrael, and the original Plishtim of Avimelech, with whom Avraham signs a treaty that for seven generations he will not enter Yerushalayim. Those seven generations are still in play when the Jews are trying to conquer Israel. A few hundred years later, David HaMelech now tries to enter Yerushalayim, and even then it's still contentious whether the Jews can enter. And there's this very strange story where there are idols of lame people and blind people surrounding the fortress of Tzion, and they're taunting the Jews, you can't come in. And according to Chazal, they're taunting the Jews because they believe that this oath, this pact, this treaty is still intact. Of course, time has already elapsed. And so by the time Shmuel Bey's Parakeh rolls around, David HaMelech, this oath has long since expired. Now the Jews can enter Yerushalayim. But what's fascinating for 2020 is that there's a pact that slows Jewish extension of sovereignty over the entire Israel. And what is the benefit? That's the price. It's a very heavy price. What are we purchasing with that secession, compromise, with that waiver? Well, at least according to the first version, and even the second version, which I'll mention in a moment, we're acquiring some land. So essentially, Avraham establishes a foothold in Beersheba, which Yitzchak then has to reinforce by redigging the wells and reinforcing that pact. It's more adversarial in Parshas Toldos. But if you look at it at 10,000 feet up, to achieve Beersheba, which is really the first Jewish foothold in Eretz Yisrael, until then Avraham's a farmer, and is a shepherd. Until then, Avraham is being hosted by Aner Eshkol Mamre, is being hosted by Malki Tzedek. Avraham's always on the run. He's always being hosted. Very famous Rashi in the beginning of Vayera, that Avraham always stayed in the same hotels when he traveled down to Egypt, and he stayed in the same hotels when he traveled back. So the core of Rashi is gratitude, but The larger message of Rashi is Avram stayed in hotels. He had no home. He was constantly being hosted by people throughout his parshios. And the closest he comes to establishing some foothold before he actually purchases a small little gravesite, but the closest he comes is Be'er Sheva, which is near Avimelech, and he establishes some central area in the south of Eretz Israel in Be'er Sheva. And he pays a price for that. He pays a price by delaying his entry into Yerushalayim. According to another version, it's not Avram and Avimelech, it's Avram and the Chittim who live in Hebron, Ephron Achiti. And part of the pact to acquire Ma'aretz HaMachpelah, part of the pact to acquire parts of Hebron, is to cede parts of Yerushalayim. We won't enter Yerushalayim for 7 years, seven generations, as long as you allow us to stabilize our presence in Hebron. So whether it's Avram ceding Yerushalayim in order to acquire Hebron from the Chittim, who then, of course, their descendants are the Yavusim, or whether it's Avram acquiring some foothold less than Hebron in Be'er Sheva, in order to acquire that first foothold, he has to give up Yerushalayim. You see the pattern. The pattern, I'll try to discuss why that's a pattern, but there is a pattern. We aren't able to extend our unanimously accepted presence over the entire part of Eretz Yisrael, and to stabilize our presence, we have to delay. It's not a deferral. It is a deferral. It's not a cancellation of a messianic prophecy. It's not a cancellation. It will come, but it can't come now. And that's literally what's happening in 2020. In order to stabilize the state of Israel internationally, diplomatically, economically, and we've got some tough economic times ahead of us. It's going to take a lot of collaboration militarily to face the threat of Iran. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for some reason, obviously HaKadosh Baruch Hu could just blink and the whole world will change, and it has changed over the last couple of months. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants this to be a human process, a human-authored process, for so many reasons. People who believe that the beginning of redemption has already commenced, it's because Hashem wants human beings to be partners. As a human process, it's staggered and it's staged, and for us to own it, then own the process, quote-unquote, then it has to be human-authored. In the human realm, in the geopolitical realm, not everyone's willing to lie down and welcome the Jewish people, and it's a slow process. Who would have believed 72 years ago that there'd be three moderate Arab countries, and more on the way, probably closer to five or six, that are not just enjoying cold peace with the state of Israel, but are truly and dearly interested in collaborating with us along many, many, many fronts. And that's the first takeaway lesson. The second takeaway lesson is that the reason that Avraham makes this pledge to Avimelech is not just, well, tit for tat. If you give me Be'er Sheva, I'll give you Yerushalayim for seven generations. It's also a moral debt. Avimelech says, I've been kind to you. He says, I've been kind to you. You owe me. And since you owe me, you have to cede seven generations of non-conquest of Yerushalayim. Which means that we can't enter Yerushalayim if it's going to come at a moral cost. Now, the question is, how do you define morality? People have different answers for that. Do you care about international opinion about our moral behavior? Some would say, we don't have to care. We answer to a higher authority. And since HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised this land to us, that is, by definition, whatever measures it takes, whatever steps it takes, that is the moral decision, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised us and wants us to be our land, first Rashi in the Torah. A different opinion could say that inasmuch as we're meant to be moral instructors of an entire world, and that's our license or our deed to Eretz Yisrael, the notion that we're going to spread our presence in Eretz Yisrael at the cost of that moral message, it's not so clear. And Avram's at that impasse. He could say, no, we're going to conquer Yerushalayim and be ungrateful, quote-unquote, to Avimelech, and say, I don't owe you anything. But he's balancing what type of impression the Jewish people will set for an international audience morally with how much land we'll be able to conquer and maintain and for how and at what stage. And at least Avram makes the decision. It's not just horse trading. I'll give you Yerushalayim if you give me Hebron. I'll give you Yerushalayim if you give me... It's also that he's in debt to the locals, in particular Avimelech, if that's the exchange, not between Hebron. He has no prior experience with Hebron. He certainly has prior experience with Avimelech. And he makes that decision. So the first part of this whole process is that Hashem wants us to gain this land both through human hand and ultimately, in a way that's not tumultuous and bellicose and militant, but that's peaceful and harmonious, because that's where we're heading. Mashiach is not a period. There may be apocalyptic wars before Mashiach, but our end point for Mashiach is universal peace and universal prosperity. And that's why the Beis HaMikdash, and there's so many psukim in Re'eh that tie into this, or that are relevant for this. You look back before the Pasuk, before the Rashi. So Hashem writes, "V'avartem es ha'yarden v'yishavtem ba'aretz," after you destroy all the avodah zarah, after you empty the land of paganism, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu will create peace, v'neach lechem mikol oyvechem misaviv v'yishavtem betach, then at that point, v'haya makom shivchar Hashem lokichem v'shaket yam shmo. And Rashi points out, at that point, when there's peace, when there's serenity, when there's tranquility, la'achah kibush v'chilek, she'neach Hashem v'haya makom, then you can build the Beis HaMikdash, but not before. And he quotes the Pasuk in Shmuel Beis, a little bit afterwards, that after they conquered Yevusi, at that point, the king was sitting in a tranquil house. V'neach Hashem mikol oyvav misaviv. All the enemies had been defeated. At that point, let's build a Beis HaMikdash. Famous Chazal, why couldn't David complete the building of Beis HaMikdash? He had blood on his hands. The blood on his hands was the blood of a Melchemes mitzvah. Every single person that David HaMelech killed was part of a mitzvah. He didn't kill anyone illegally. He wasn't a murderer. He didn't have a bad record. No blood on his hands. Halavai that we should have, halavai should I should have that blood on my hands if I could be the Melech Yisrael who was fulfilling the Ratzon HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It just wasn't suitable. It wasn't appropriate. It wasn't compatible with that era. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted an era of peace, because Beis HaMikdash is supposed to be based on Yikar Elech Olamim. So our whole goal to get to Yushalayim is to build a Beis HaMikdash and to draw HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Melech Shalom Shalom, into our world. That has to be affected with some degree of international agreement, acquiescence. It can't be coerced, it can't be imposed, because then it defeats the purpose. Now, where that balance lies, one could say, well, we already have all the international acquiescence we need in 1948, and we don't need to form alliances with local Arab countries. But there is a pattern here that we forestall space and real estate in order to create healthy, harmonious, peaceful, conciliatory relations. And in the case, of course, of, and that's really what it's about. I mean, obviously, people are speaking about annexing of larger swaths of the West Bank and of Shimon, but it's all Yerushalayim. It's all the card of Yerushalayim. So imagine Yerushalayim is one long metropolis spanning from Shechem and Beit Del all the way down to Beit Lechem and Hebron. It's all, this is when we say Yerushalayim, this is what a Jew means. It means the Yerushalayim, meaning the landscape of Sefer Bereishis, the landscape of our Avos. So Avram seeds Yerushalayim in order that Yerushalayim should be not conquered, and he preserves that pact, in order that it shouldn't be conquered in an aggressive, warlike fashion. It should be conquered, essentially, there is a war in the end with the Yevusim, but it's a war that essentially Avimelech has ceded already. After seven generations, they're yours, you can enter Yerushalayim. Because Yerushalayim is a place of the Mikdash, and the Mikdash has to have some degree of acquiescence, not just coercion. And he's willing to pay a price for that. Or if you want to see it through a different lens, not just the Pasuk in Parshas Re'eh that talks about the construction of the Beis HaMikdash only after there's peace and tranquility, but the terms Menucha v'Nachala. Ki lo basa manata ela Menucha v'yala Nachala. So until there's Menucha, we may have, in order or to achieve Menucha, and Menucha at its core level means peace, tranquility, lack of war, we may have to compromise some of the rights of Nachala. Every centimeter of land in this area is promised to us by Kadosh Baruch Hu. But is it important for us to achieve Menucha, and are we willing to pay the price of at least how much of our sovereignty we extend over Nachala? So this is the first reason. The first reason is to achieve presence in Yerushalayim with some degree of recognition and acquiescence. Number two, not just that Yerushalayim should be a consensus, but that we shouldn't, I want to say violate is a hard word, but that our extending our presence in Yerushalayim should not come at the cost of our ability to instruct the world morally. And that instruction can be gauged in two ways. Some would say, we're providing a moral message. It doesn't make a difference that our audiences can't see it. Other people will say, well, if they can't see it, then we're not necessarily providing it. So It could cut two ways, but it's clear that Avraham's commitment isn't just based on a tit for tat, I want land, I'll give you land. It's also based on, I don't want to be ungrateful and disloyal in a way that would compromise the moral message just on behalf of getting land earlier. The third reason, and I'm not blissfully naive, I know the United Arab Emirates are not interested in the state of Israel because of our moral messages. They're not lining up to come to Mashiach, or they're not lining up to come to Shivat Har Zion. We don't have room for them. I'm in charge of admissions. I used to be, but I used to be in charge of admissions. I'm not going to admit United Arab Emirates students to the yeshiva. They're interested in our technology. They're interested in our security arrangements. They're interested in our economic opportunities because they're Israeli tourists. I should be careful. Be careful what you wish for. Israeli tourists are a little bit notorious for leaving behind a little bit of a trail of tourist carnage. But anyway, they're interested in larger cultural issues, not moral issues, but that is itself an advance. And that's based on another Rashi. So three Rashis, two in Parshas Re, and one in Parshas Vezos HaBracha. In Parshas Vezos HaBracha, so Zevulun is described. Now Zevulun lived on the sea, and there were seafaring merchants. And that's described in the first pasuk as Zevulun, Smach Zevulun Mitzesecha. You're always charting out to sea. But then a very strange pasuk, Amim Har Yikro. The nations will call the mountain. Mountains are always iconic. They refer to the mountain, Har Moriah. Sham Yizbechu Zivchei Tzedek. Why is Zevulun specified or designated as, they didn't live near the mountains, they lived on the seas, they weren't Kohanim, they weren't officiating Korbanos. What did Korbanos have to do with Zevulun? So Rashi has a first interpretation. This isn't really specifically about Zevulun, but a second interpretation really is that their trade partners will land on the sea and they'll say, well, we've already landed in Israel for our gems, for our diamonds to trade with Zevulun. May as well go to Yerushalayim and see what these people are up to. And they travel from the coast to Yerushalayim to the mountain. And at that point, they get exposure to religion. And at that point, they get exposure to Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad. So the catch is Zevulun, seafaring, economy, commerce, diamonds, jewels, economic interests, cultural interests. But slowly over time, this transforms into a religious and moral message because they travel to Yerushalayim. Is that what's happening? Are we going to look back at these events in 200 years? And we'll say, well, that's how it started. It started with security arrangements and economic partnerships and common enemy of Iran, but then at some point when people warmed to the state of Israel, we're no longer the Zionist enemy, at some point they were willing to listen and learn. And is this part of turning the world's attention to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? These things may not happen overnight. So these are three reasons or three elements for why Avraham may be willing to pay a price in raw square meters of land in order to win the alliances, the moral appreciation, and the associations culturally with his cohabitants, with the Avimelechs of the world, the Ephronachites of the world, the people who otherwise would be adversarial to him. A, because the march to Yerushalayim has to be a march of peace and tranquility. Even at the price, Avram feels of Menucha, of Nachala, he's willing to achieve Menucha. In order to build the base of Mikdash, it has to be a period of tranquility and peace and sedation. Number two, because our message, which is our deed for being in Eretz Yisrael, is a message of morality. So if we're not seen that way, is that a compromise of our message? And what compromises are we willing to make in order for that message, right? The Israeli army is routinely accused of being immoral. I know that for a fact they're not. I have my own children serving. I listen, my son is now a commander in the Golani unit. I hear about the measures they take to try to protect every life as best as possible under very, very trying circumstances. Number three, by creating cultural interests, you are actually drawing people's interests and curiosity, which one day, hopefully, will once again convert or transform into religious awakening. Now, I should conclude by highlighting the context of this pact between Avram and Avimelech and highlighting that it may feel a little bit different in our day. Remember, Avram is signing a pact with Avimelech, and essentially he's extending his presence on the land of Israel by ceding land to non-Yishmael personalities. Avimelech is a lot of things, but he's not been a Yishmael. Ephron Achiti is a lot of things, but he's not Yishmael. Despite what the Palestinians may claim, they don't draw from the original inhabitants of the land. They're Arabs that migrated to the Jordan, migrated to Israel, migrated to Palestine before it was Israel, or whatever, and migrated from different locations in the Middle East. So, and especially the context of Avram's pact with Avimelech is so crucial because it's right in between two selections of Yitzchak from Yishmael. First, Kibi Yitzchak Yikar Lechazara. Sarah sends Yishmael off and sends Hagar off and cements Yitzchak's selection. And then the pact with Avimelech, and then the Akedah. This is familiar to all of us in Rosh Hashanah. On the first day, we read about the discharge of Yitzchak, and we read about the pact with Avimelech, and then the second day, Har Moriah. So if you want, there's a sandwich. First, Yishmael is discarded, and then as part of that selection of Yitzchak, that will extend his presence in Eretz Yisrael, and will form him as a moral example, Avram signs his pact with Avimelech, and then after the pact, then they can stand at Har Moriah in a way that's very foretelling and foreshadowing of the end of days when everyone will be at Har Moriah. Now, it's a little bit different today because it's essentially signing a pact with some Arab nations, even though other Arab nations still oppose our presence here. So in Sefer Vayera, there really are three parties involved. Yishmael has been discarded. Yitzchak is advancing. As part of that advance is signing pacts and treaties with locals. Here it's there's a broader Arab world, much of which is still opposed to our presence in Eretz Yisrael, but some of which is being welcomed. So it's a slightly different structure, but it's a very, very similar phenomena. And let's hope that we're able to continue to draw these messages from HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah and help us at least better understand, there's a lot of swirl and a lot of conversation, how to process what happened today in the Middle East.